Agnes had been suspicious of this strange man at the hostel in Liège, where she worked for several days a week. Something didn't seem right about this strange man. He was definitely not from around here. She could hear that in his voice. The man claimed to be a businessman from the Rhineland, but Agnes couldn't quite believe it. Something told her that she had even seen this man before in her life, far away from Liège, towards the Ruhr River, perhaps. But maybe Agnes was wrong. She was only a maid, what could she possibly know? But then something happened that made Agnes sit up and take notice. The merchant was washing his hands in a bowl filled with water, but instead of using the towel which was lying next to it, he completely disregarded the towel. He took his hands out of the bowl and slapped them together, like this. A funny way to dry his hands, but Agnes was completely taken aback at that moment. She immediately left the tavern without letting anything show, and once she was out of sight of her workplace, she quickened her pace through the streets of Liège, which is nowadays in Belgium. She didn't have to hurry far. She knocked on the door of a house where a knight named Balduin of Gennep was staying, and where she knew why he was passing through Liège. When she was let through to Knight Balduin, it burst straight out of her. "I found the murderer. I know where Count Friedrich von Isenberg is." And Knight Balduin jumped up immediately. "Take me to him at once." And with that, off to the intro. What an intro, right? Don't worry. We will, of course, resolve the story in this episode. But for now, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as quite the microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. Do you remember the German throne conflict, which also occupied us here in the podcast for several episodes? It lasted from 1198 to 1218. And don't worry, this time it really ends here. Forever. But just a quick refresher, as it was a few episodes ago. Henry VI died far too young and unexpectedly in 1197. His much younger son Frederick was far away in Sicily. The Hohenstaufen, Philip of Swabia, the uncle of Frederick, who was still far too young, was initially victorious in the German throne dispute. However, after Philip fell victim to an insidious murder in 1208, the Welf and Philip's adversary, Otto IV, became the undisputed ruler. However, he soon lost the support of the Pope and was excommunicated. This led to the return of the Hohenstaufen dynasty under the now adult Frederick II through successful political maneuvers, including an alliance with France. The decision between Frederick and Otto was finally made at the Battle of Bouvines in 1214, and Otto IV died in 1218, left alone by his English relatives and above all by his allies in the Rhineland, such as Cologne. Cologne had once again switched its support and had already recognized the Hohenstaufen Frederick II as new ruler in 1215. That, dear people, is now really hard to cut short. The German throne controversy had raged for almost 20 years and caused a lot of upheaval. In Cologne too, all these changing alliances had thrown a lot of things into disarray. As described in previous episodes, there were two archbishops of Cologne in 1215, Adolf of Altena and Dietrich. Neither of them was able to assert themselves, however, as they were either unpopular with the new ruler and or the Pope. Both were thus declared deposed in 1215. When it came to electing a new archbishop, the rulers of the Cologne Church unanimously chose a new candidate who was acceptable to both the Pope and the new ruler of the Empire, Frederick II. And this new Archbishop of Cologne was Engelbert of Berg. We have already covered many of the Archbishops of Cologne here. As secular rulers of Cologne, they are essential to understanding the history of the city. From time to time, we have had the impression that some of these officials were in fact more interested in secular than ecclesiastical activities, like Reinhard of Dassel, who as a general always fought in Italy and even avoided being officially ordained as a priest until the end of his life. With Engelbert of Berg, we once again have a ruler of this caliber. At least that's said about him. We will get to that later at the end. And that's not just my own personal opinion. Contemporaries also saw it that way. Caesarius of Heisterbach, for example. Caesarius was probably born in Cologne around 1180 and came from a wealthy family. He studied at the ecclesiastical schools of St. Andrew and Cologne Cathedral and eventually became a monk at Heisterbach Monastery in the Siebengebirge Mountains, around 30 kilometers south of Cologne, near Bonn. It really is a beautiful monastery, and although the church itself is only a ruin nowadays, it still looks very beautiful. However, other buildings of the monastery have been preserved, perfect for a day trip if you're around the area of Cologne. In addition to his tasks and duties as a monk, Caesarius excelled above all as a writer. He is known to have written at least 39 works, if not more. As a contemporary witness of Archbishop Engelbert, he naturally also wrote a vita about the Cologne city ruler. And interestingly enough, it was unambiguous. Engelbert was a hot-tempered and would probably have been a better duke than a bishop. Nevertheless, Caesarius credited him with the fact that the Cologne church was more powerful in the Rhineland and Westphalia at his time than it had been since at least Bruno I. And that, dear people, was a long time ago in the middle of the 10th century. And remember, Bruno had also been the brother of Emperor Otto the Great. Praise and criticism at the same time. But who was Engelbert? Who became Archbishop of Cologne in 1216? And what challenges did Engelbert face? Let's find it out after a short breather. In February 1216, Engelbert of Berg was elected the new Archbishop of Cologne. Born around 1185, Engelbert was born into the important dynasty of the Counts of Berg. This important dynasty, which we will soon be looking at in a separate podcast episode, had enjoyed an astonishing rise since the 11th century. Members of the of Berg family had already occupied the archiepiscopal see in Cologne three times before in the 12th century. The first was Bruno II, who held office for 6 years from 1131 to 1137, but the historical sources are very sparse, so sadly we don't know much about him. The next two candidates from the House of Berg both had very short terms of office. Archbishop Frederick II died after just 2 years in 1158, and Bruno III abdicated only after 2 years in 1193 to make way for his nephew, Adolf of Altena, well known to us from the German throne controversy. Engelbert was now the fourth candidate from the House of the Counts of Berg. As the second son of his father of the same name and his mother Margarete of Geldern, he was destined for a clerical career as a nobleman. It is obvious that they ensured that he quickly rose through the ranks of the Cologne Church. After all, Engelbert was the cousin of Archbishop Adolf of Altena, who was in office at the time of his education. He received his education at the Cologne Cathedral School. It didn't get any better than that in Cologne. As already mentioned, his year of birth is given as around 1185 or maybe 1186. Nevertheless, he was extremely young when he became a provost of St. George's in 1198, a church that Anno had once founded in his time. Roughly speaking, a provost is the head of the monastery, who primarily regulated the economic aspects and thus also earned money from the benefices, like the monastery's income. A lucrative post. And just 1 year later, he was also elected provost of Cologne Cathedral. Remember, his uncle Adolf of Altena was still archbishop at the time, and Engelbert must have been a teenager at the time when he was elected. And this probably caused a direct dispute within the Cologne Cathedral chapter, the members of the Cologne Cathedral Monastery. Because the much too young age, let's assume Engelbert had already been born in 1185, then he would have been only 14 years old when he was elected cathedral provost, was the bone of contention. And so the opposing candidate, who had not won a majority in the election, but was still old enough, did not back down. It was not until 1203 that Engelbert finally prevailed in the fight as cathedral provost in a new election. By then, he was probably already an adult, in the opinion of the time. If the office of provost of Cologne Cathedral wasn't already powerful enough and very lucrative in terms of income, he spent the next few years diligently collecting further posts as provost, even of St. Mary's in Aachen, which is today's Aachen Cathedral, the last resting place of Charlemagne. As the dispute over the German throne gathered pace, Engelbert initially aligned himself with his uncle, Archbishop Adolf of Altena. However, he kept a low profile and waited to see how the battle between the Hohenstaufen and the Welf dynasties would develop. His desire for, shall we say, worldly pleasures, which is being said about him, to the neglect of spiritual duties was already evident at this time. In 1212, he moved with his older brother, Count Adolf III of Berg, to the south of France to fight against the Albigensians, who were scorned as heretics. The geographical and intellectual distance to Cologne and the Rhineland was probably not unwise at that time. In this way, Engelbert avoided the dispute within the Cologne archbishopric between his deposed uncle, Adolf of Altena, and Dietrich on the other side. When Pope Innocent III declared both squabbles deposed in 1215 and called for a new election, Engelbert had the best cards. He held numerous positions within the Church of Cologne, was thus endowed with sufficient wealth, came from a powerful and well-connected noble family from the region, and had behaved largely unscathed. Better still, he had even fought heretics in the far south of France. And, like the city of Cologne in 1214, he had sided with Frederick II of Hohenstaufen in good time, who now ruled the empire de facto and undisputedly as the new king, when the election of the Bishop of Cologne was scheduled for early 1216. So it is any wonder that Engelbert was anonymously elected as the new Archbishop of Cologne February 1216? This de facto This election created a really powerful bloc, which even created a large contiguous geographical area. Yes, I know in the Middle Ages we can hardly speak of territorially contiguous areas, but as I said, the consolidation of one's own dominion, the territorialization, was a goal that many magnates pursued at that time. Since the dismemberment of the territories that had once been under the rule of Henry the Lion at the end of the 12th century, the Church of Cologne had been able to permanently gain the Duchy of Westphalia, which had broken away from Saxony for itself. This was the first time that the Church of Cologne had been able to extend its secular power over a large area on the right bank of the Rhine. The crux of the matter was that it was too far to the right of the Rhine. There was no direct land connection between Cologne and Westphalia. Thus, the newly acquired Duchy of Westphalia with Arnsberg in the center of that area was an exclave outside the remaining major part of the left bank of the Rhine. Can you follow me so far? If not, I will post a map on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. But guess what exactly lay between Cologne and Westphalia? That's right, the possessions of the Count of Berg. And Engelbert belonged to precisely this noble family of Berg. In theory, when Engelbert took office, there was now a contiguous area that connected large parts of the left bank of the Rhine, belonging to the Church of Cologne, with the possessions of the Count of Berg on the right bank of the Rhine, where the Duchy of Westphalia then directly adjoined to the east. As I said, only in theory. What we must never forget, it only looks like that on a map. The local nobles in these areas certainly saw differently, and the three adjoining territories, Duchy of Westphalia, the Archbishopric of Cologne, and the County of Berg, they were all three still independent political units, and they were not centrally organized and governed internally either. But Engelbert would still pursue this goal. a centralization of the archiepiscopal power, so his own direct power, and the creation of a coherent territory under the rule of the House of the Counts of Berg. That was the vision for now, but the reality was of course different. After all, Engelbert had several challenges to overcome when he took office. So let's take a look at his personal perspective. The Archbishopric of Cologne had been devastated by almost 20 years of war and had to be rebuilt. The spiritual and temporal power of the archbishop in his lands had suffered considerably due to the long years of uncertainty as to who the legitimate archbishop was. Many a local nobleman took advantage of the absence of the local archbishop's authority to grant himself more rights, property and privileges, or to build themselves a castle without permission. And there were exterior enemies as well. The Duke of Limburg and the Count of Kleve were a particular thorn in Engelbert's side. The former bordered Engelbert's domain to the west and the latter to the north. And as I said, I'll put a map on the homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. From his point of view, Engelbert's point of view, there was also a lot going wrong in his residence city, Cologne. In an unprecedented process, the citizens of the city had shamelessly exploited the turmoil within the empire and the Archbishopric of Cologne to emancipate themselves from the city ruler, so him, the Archbishop of Cologne. The citizens of Cologne were the first city in the empire to obtain privileges directly from the Pope and have charters issued directly by the king and emperor to themselves. In doing so, they had bypassed the archbishop as the supreme ruler in recent years, the ruler of the city. Engelbert strongly opposed this development, and he had luck doing that because he was able to rely on royal support as the young Frederick II also pursued an anti-city policy in the empire. And after a short break, we found out how this affected Cologne and ended the first short-lived Cologne City Council. When studying history, we are often faced with the problem that we never know exactly when many things started, especially in medieval times. This is also the case with the first known council of the city of Cologne. We only know about its end, but first things first. The question we should ask ourselves, why was a city council created in Cologne? There was already the College of Jurors and the Richterzeche, both of which were often even intertwined and set out to represent the citizens of Cologne. However, for the most part, only the wealthiest class of Cologne citizens were represented there. The College of Jurors was also an archiepiscopal body. So who formed this first council of the city of Cologne, which wanted to be independent of the city's previous power structures? Logically, the Richterzeche, the jurors, and the archbishop did not. The craftsmen's guilds certainly didn't either, as they were still too politically insignificant at the time. What remains, however, are the brotherhoods, the cooperatives of the wards. Remember episode number 54 in this podcast. There we discussed the political development of Cologne in the Middle Ages, that the city organized itself locally in special districts. I call them wards because I have never found a good translation for that in English. But these wards were mostly based on the parish boundaries inside the city. In the 12th century, it was often the case that people saw themselves as inhabitants of the respective special parish, the ward, and not primarily as inhabitants of Cologne at first. Locally, these wards settled minor legal issues, elected representatives to a cooperative organizational body, collected taxes, and above all, recorded legal transactions in the shrine books. At first, people kept to themselves within their special, their ward. It was only over time that a sense of communal togetherness developed between the wards. This was achieved here at the beginning of the 13th century. The inhabitants of the individual wards, or rather the cooperative governing bodies, joined forces and created the first city council of Cologne. The first documented Cologne city council to oppose the previous dominance of the archbishop, the College of Jurors, and the Richterzeche dates back to 1216, when the council issued a charter for a monastery in Westphalia. This was a period that is significant, as at this time it was politically opportune for the Wards to go one's own way. Two candidates had been fighting for years now for the leadership of the Archbishopric of Cologne, and this political vacuum was undoubtedly exploited by the Wards. Apparently, there were enough people in the city who did not feel adequately represented by the previous institutions as the Richardzeche or the College of Jurors. How did the city's other bodies react to this development? Well, we don't know for sure, but in the aforementioned document from the town council to the monastery in Westphalia, the jurors are also listed. A few jurors were listed as witnesses, which was common when signing a document. This meant that not all jurors were generally hostile to the new body. However, many will not have approved of having to share their old power with new people. And this is shown by the following development. You know now what also happened in 1216. Not only do we hear about the Cologne City Council for the first time in historical sources, it was also the time where the schism within the Archbishopric of Cologne ended, with the election of Engelbert as bishop in 1216. A man came to power who was prepared to crack down and restore the archbishop's power. And long story short, he just put an end to the first council of the city of Cologne in the same year. Why did Engelbert dissolve this town council, this city council, in the same year? A municipal body had been formed that the archbishop had no access to. Unlike the College of Jurors, which was a body subordinate to him for the maintenance of city rule and the courts of the city, this was not the case with the city council. And remember, every juror had to swear an oath to the archbishop. Here, in the College of Jurors, the archbishop had a decisive hand in deciding who was admitted. Indirectly, this also applied to the Richardzeche, although it was founded by rich citizens outside the archbishop's control back then. Every juror was automatically a member of this brotherhood of the rich, the Richardzeche, and one of the two mayors of the Richardzeche was always a juror as well, and therefore also in some way in the hands of the archbishop's power. What made the city council just as special? It was elected annually. In the College of Jurors, or the Richardzeche, on the other hand, people were appointed for life. This severely restricted the circle of men to be controlled, as there was hardly any rotation in the offices over the years. However, a city council with constantly changing members each year would have opened the door for broad sections of the city population, especially the middle class, to become politically active. More people in the city who could be politically active also meant a more difficult position for the archbishop to maintain his rule of the city. So, it was better to keep the circle smaller and limited in order to have a better overview. I hope you can follow me. The archbishop's perspective. The first council of the city of Cologne was thus already history in 1216, but don't worry, it would reappear just a few years later, and then it would stay. Through the turmoil of time, it still exists today, with only a few interruptions in over 800 years. As of 2024, 90 men and women in total sit on Cologne City Council and decide on many of the city's issues. How well they do this is up to you to decide, but new elections are held here every 5 years. Many in the College of Jurors will certainly have rejoiced when this Cologne City Council was crushed by Engelbert in 1216, but here too, Engelbert cracked down as well. In the meantime, the College of Jurors had become popular with the richest inhabitants in order to obtain benefices. This was the income that the College of Jurors generated from granting of rights, properties, or fees at court or custom duties. As the original advisors in court proceedings, not all jurors had been so hardworking then, at that time. Engelbert now forced them to work every day, except Sundays and holidays, of course. The jurors were to work in court and had a maximum of only 3 days to pass a judgment. To ensure this, Engelbert now often sat as a judge himself at the High Court. He was, of course, entitled to do so, but in the past the archbishops had often left this right to their Burggraf. But now Engelbert often took the charge, And many jurors were complaining in silence, I guess, about that, that they really had to work for their job. Engelbert thus clamped down on the city and turned back the clock on civic emancipation for his term of office. Documents from this period between the city and the emperor are now primarily addressed to the Archbishop of Cologne. During this period, Cologne, like Soest or Bonn, was only one of many cities in the Archbishopric of Cologne. Quite a few of the rich inhabitants of Cologne will have grumbled about this and longed for the turbulent but more autonomous times of Barbarossa or to the fall, for they had direct access to imperial power. Engelbert also celebrated successes in foreign policy. He defeated his opponents in the Rhineland in several feuds, primarily the Duke of Limburg and the Count of Kleve. It was not only the Duke of Limburg, Wilhelm III, who threatened him with his expansionist policies. The Limburgers, the Dukes of Limburg, the Dynasty of Limburg, also threatened his own dynasty. In 1218, Engelbert's older brother, Count Adolf III of Berg, with whom Engelbert had previously worked well together, died. Adolf III had a daughter, whom he had married previously to Duke Wilhelm III of Limburg in 1216. Despite the marriage, and I think you guys know why people married in medieval times among nobles, it was to smoothen out political tensions that, as we know now, did not work properly. And so, on the contrary, Engelbert and Adolf had even considered whether it would not be wise to have the marriage annulled between those two, for the very same political reasons that the marriage did not benefit the of Berg family. But now, Adolf III, Count of Berg, was dead before they could have annulled the marriage between Adolf's daughter and Duke Wilhelm III. Sorry, I was just stumbling because there's a big storm coming outside and I had to look if not rain would come in the window. However, Adolf III, Count of Berg, was dead, far from home in Egypt as a participant in the Fifth Crusade from an epidemic. Did the County of Berg now fall to the Duke of Limburg in 1218? After all, he was married to the daughter of Adolf III of Berg and he had no sons. However, Engelbert cleverly knew how to prevent this. He himself, as Archbishop of Cologne, took possession of the County of Berg on behalf of his niece. And as compensation, Engelbert paid the Duke of Limburg an annual sum of money. If that were not enough, the Emperor Frederick II, who was friendly towards Engelbert, appointed him tutor to his son and heir, Henry, whom he had already had elected as co-king. As Henry was still too young, the Emperor also made Engelbert imperial administrator as a regent. Now Engelbert was the first deputy of the co-king and acted as a regent. Sorry, the storm just... The storm is irritating. I try to concentrate now. The emperor thus gave Engelbert a largely free hand in the part of the empire north of the Alps, which was the majority of the empire, while Frederick increasingly shifted his attention back to the Italian part of the empire, where he had spent most of his life. Engelbert had thus reached the peak of his power in 1220. But on the way there, he had, shall we say, disgruntled many people, powerful regional nobles such as the Duke of Limburg, who felt cheated out of his inheritance. The rich citizens of Cologne felt that their rights had been curtailed, and the people themselves also suffered from the increased tax burden that Engelbert had introduced in order to carry out his expansionist policies and the rebuilding of the archbishopric. Engelbert had castles built all over the Rhineland in order to expand and secure the archbishop's power in the Archbishopric of Cologne, and guess what? That costs a lot. And that, dear people, as the intro already foreshadowed, was to become one of the reasons why we are looking for a murderer. More on this after a short break. The year is now 1225, and Engelbert has now been Archbishop of Cologne and Duke of Westphalia for 9 years. For 7 years, he has also been invested with the power of a Count of Berg, and for 5 years, He has been the imperial administrator, the regent, of the Empire of the Alps. In November of that year of 1225, Engelbert rode to Essen, in what is now in the Ruhr region. He wanted to act as a mediator there. A major dispute had broken out here. Who was to receive the bailiwick rights of the Essen Abbey? In other words, who would take over the secular administrative and financial management of the monastery, which was strategically located at the crossroads of the Hellweg? The Hellweg was one of the major east-west roads in the empire. A lot of trade went on that road, and whoever controlled this monastery at that crossroad would gain enormous power, prestige, and wealth. The parties to the dispute were the Count Friedrich of Isenburg, and I say his German name so that you are not confused with the Emperor Frederick of the same name. And this guy, Friedrich of Isenburg, was, hold on to your seats, he was a second cousin of Engelbert. And on the other side of the dispute was a convent of ladies, a ladies' convent in Soest. Both claimed the bailiwick rights for themselves here in Essen. The negotiations dragged on for a miserably long time, so long that Engelbert decided to interrupt the negotiations between the two parties for a while, as he wanted to consecrate a new church further south of Essen in Schwelm. Then his cousin, Count Friedrich of Isenberg, came up with an ingenious idea. Or at least he thought it was a brilliant idea. He could strengthen his negotiation position, so to speak, in the dispute over the Essen Abbey if he had the mediator in his custody. And so Count Friedrich of Isenberg really did lie in wait for his relative along a road and attacked Engelbert and his traveling party on November 9th, 1225. What happened next, and whether capture was really the true objective here, is still a subject of passionate debate today. But we do know that the outcome was as follows. At the end of this attack, Engelbert lay dead on the road with 47 bleeding wounds. The fact that Engelbert was really brutally murdered, as the historical sources say, has also been established in recent scientific studies of his skeleton, which has been preserved to this day. If a capture had really been planned here, well, I don't want to be a judge here, but it had failed miserably. According to the writer Caesarius of Heisterbach, Engelbert was not only a worthy priest, but also a brave warrior. So, whatever had happened during the attack, Engelbert had not simply been murdered, he had been downright slaughtered. The historians Karl Dietmar and Hugo Stehkämper suspect a conspiracy at the head of which was Duke Wilhelm III of Limburg, the man who had previously been denied the possessions by the dynasty of Berg by Engelbert despite his legitimate claim to inheritance. This conspiracy is said to have been joined by a number of wealthy citizens of Cologne and other local Rhenish and Westphalian nobles such as the Bishop of Münster and Osnabrück, who were weary of Engelbert's great power. And I know this episode is already quite long, but Walter von der Vogelweide, the great German lyricist of the Middle Ages, a contemporary of that time, sang about Engelbert's death in a wonderful, lyrical, old German way. Praise for the murdered man and curses for the murderer. Forgive me, I won't sing it now because I have no idea how to sing that, but I will at least read it out. But of course translate into English, which of course means some of the beauty of his words is getting lost due to the translation. But let's do it anyway. Quote, I praise his life and always mourn his death. Woe to him who slew the noble prince of Cologne. Oh, that the earth would still bear him. I know of no torture great enough for his guilt. A rope of oak around his neck would be too gentle for him. I will not burn him, nor cut him in pieces, nor pull off his hair, nor crush him with the wheel, nor weave him on the wheel. I only wait every day to see if hell will not devour him alive. End quote. Ah, that was beautiful, wasn't it? In old German it sounds even better, but let's leave that. But even though some Cologne citizens took part in the conspiracy, let's assume that, and some are even said to have publicly burned his documents in front of the cathedral when his death was announced, the majority of the city's population was horrified by the murder of their city lord and swore revenge. The Cologne Cathedral chapter also offered a reward for the murderer of the archbishop, and that was 500 kilograms of silver. A truly high, even dizzying sum for the time. Whether the maid that I named as Agnes in the intro really existed, or wherever it belongs in the realm of legends, is up to you. But what is true, in Liège, in what is now Belgium, the knight Balduin of Genep apprehended the fugitive murderer who had been able to hide for a year. Always on the run, always in fear of being discovered, which now finally happened in Liège. Balduin of Genep brought the murderer to Cologne and collected the reward, and Count Friedrich of Isenberg was executed in extremely brutal manner in front of the Severin's castle in the south of Cologne. He was executed with a wheel, which is really not a nice thing to do, because the executioner broke the condemned man's limbs with a large, heavy wagon wheel. The executioner then tied the broken limbs between the spokes of the wheel. This was an extremely dishonorable and torturous method of execution that was reserved for the worst criminals, such as murderers. The contemporary judgment of Engelbert really depends on the perspective of the individual. Some rich citizens and sections of the middle class will not have remembered Engelbert so fondly. After all, he curtailed civil rights and freedoms that had been fought for so hard in recent times, and he had also banned the first council of the city of Cologne. However, by establishing mendicant orders such as the Franciscans and Dominicans and tolerating Beguine convents during his time in office, he helped Cologne to flourish spiritually. The deeply pious, charitable, and educated priests of these mendicant orders, as well as the numerous ladies from the Beguine convents within the city, met with great sympathy from the ordinary city population as they hoped for better salvation for their souls, as well as relief in their everyday lives. It was not uncommon for these monks to run hospitals and care for the poor and sick, and at a time when they were far removed, when we were far removed from the welfare state, this made them, those mendicant orders and Beguines, very popular with the wider population. And Engelbert had made this possible with settling those mendicant orders and Beguine convents in Cologne, and also giving them land, houses, churches, and privileges. Caesarius's remark that Engelbert did not always take his spiritual duties quite so seriously, as already said in the intro of this episode, should therefore not always be taken at face value. Cologne has held Engelbert in great honor ever since. He is buried in the old Cologne Cathedral, and in 1260 he was then reburied in the new Gothic Cologne Cathedral, which had just been started. His veneration experienced a renaissance in the 17th century, and in 1633 he was reburied in a magnificent new Baroque shrine. You can see it today in the Cologne Cathedral Treasury. I will put photos of it online on the homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. And of course, he is also depicted on as a historical figure on the City Hall Tower of Cologne, which I think is quite ironic because he crushed down the first city council of Cologne. In the next episode, we will shed light on the impact Engelbert's death had on the Berg dynasty, because the lords of Berg have served their own and deserve their own podcast episode. After all, many of their former estates are now, nowadays, parts of modern Cologne. It is not possible to tell a story of Cologne without the story of the lords of Berg. That's what we'll do in the next episode. So, let's leave it for today. What did I use as the basis for this episode? I took the legend from the intro and enriched it with my own content from Gosin Peter Gard's Kölner Sagen, so Cologne Legends. I used Cologne in the High Middle Ages, or in German Köln im Hochmittelalter, by Karl Dietmar and Hugo Stegkemper as scientific basis. I also used the academic article by Sven Holger Brunsch on Engelbert I on the online platform Rheinische Geschichte, or in English Rhenish History. And I also used Die Herren vom Berg, in English The Lords of Berg, by Hans-Jürg Laute, and Die Geschichte des Bergischen Landes, or The History of the Bergish Lands, by Franz Gruß, with a new edition by Klaus Herdepe. In the end, I just have to say thank you. Thank you to my patrons who helped me to keep this podcast going. Welcome to Steve and Alexander as new members on Patreon. Thanks also to those who have thrown something to my hat via PayPal. Thanks to Silvia, Ingo, Günther, Joachim and Michael. Thanks to every one of you for listening, of course. Please recommend me, stay loyal, and auf Wiedersehen.